We are in Ecclesiastes chapter 9. Solomon, probably towards the end of his life in desperation, is recording his frustration with life. The continued theme is life under the sun. It's a worldly perspective. It's without the perspective of eternity and the spirit. And he's a guy that has had it all. He says he withheld no pleasure or no desire of any sort from himself. And he wallowed and all the things of this world that men say might fulfill, and continually found himself frustrated and empty. And as he begins in this ninth chapter, he's continuing a thought from 8, around verse 14 there, where he's talking about the vanity of the righteous man to whom it happens as the wicked. The idea is he's seen a righteous man who's done what's right, and he ended up having calamity in his life or judgment come upon him, as it seems like should come on the wicked. And he's seen the wicked man seemingly reaping the rewards of the righteous. And he says this is a terrible thing, and it's vanity, and it's without explanation, and trying to know it is beyond finding out. It's the theme of Psalm 73 as we read that, the prospering of the wicked and the suffering of the righteous. And Isaiah says God will take a righteous man sometimes out of this world to save him further calamity, because he loves that man and no one lays it to heart. They all think the wrong thing as they try to understand it. And of course, how hard it is for us to understand. And chapter 9 begins with that thought. For all this I considered in my heart, even to declare all this, that the righteous and the wise and their works are in the hand of God. And no man knoweth either love or hatred by all that is before them. So by examining life, he said, he found a lack of equity. It was, as we would say, unfair. One of the, I think, our favorite phrases when things seem to go wrong is, it's not fair, you know. And sometimes it's not. Even as we look at some of the tragedy, in a sense, of Steve Smith losing the pastor of Calvary over Morristown, lost his son a few years ago, 3.5 years old, or Rich Bozzi, and you think, you know, Lord, in some sense, it's not fair. I mean, there are those who abuse their children, who don't care about them, who get abortions, who give them up, who beat them, who don't care about them. And here we are with all the love and concern to raise a kid the right way, to see him go on and fulfill something in life and walk with integrity and dignity and separate in this world and be a witness for you. And then there's that looking at it and saying it's not fair. As we weigh it in the balances of our own logic, I would certainly say that it isn't. And he says, as I look around at life, by reason, by logic, I can't discover hatred or love as I look around, because I see the righteous falling into calamity, which doesn't seem like love, and I see the wicked prospering, which doesn't seem right. So by observation, as I sought to find these things out, he said there was no real discovering of them. I didn't see the fairness. And the idea is, of course, man needs a revelation beyond that which he sees by observation in nature and in the circumstances of life. Of course, the wonderful thing for us is that we've seen God in Christ. We've seen him with the children. We've seen him with the harlot. We've seen him with the sinners. We've seen him with so many, healing and caring and weeping and loving and holding the children on his lap and promising us many things about glory. So we have a different revelation of who God is as we are faced with the unfairness of life quite often. There is at least in our lives a file that says questions to be asked in heaven. You know, that God is innocent till proven guilty, as it were. I don't understand why God is doing this, and it hurts, and it's extremely painful, but Jesus, we've seen him in Jesus. We've seen him walking among us. We've seen the display of his love. We've seen him trading away his own life for ours, as it were. And there's that logic, Paul says, of the cross, that if God has already given us the best that the universe has to offer, his own son, shall he not with him also give us all things freely? That God won't deny us anything else. So Solomon, without that insight, the wisest man the world has ever known, more wisdom than anybody else in regards to things on this level, enjoying every pleasure and everything that he can indulge himself in, expanding his own mind in regards to philosophy and wisdom, all these things, and says, yet in the natural there's no way to look at it and to weigh it out and to discover fairness in it all, as it were. All things come alike, he says, and all there is one event to the righteous and to the wicked. But, you know, the same thing comes to both, to the good and to the clean, to the unclean. To him that sacrifices, and to him that sacrificeth not. As is the good, so is the sinner. And he that sweareth, as he that feareth an oath. And there is an evil among all things that are done under the sun, that there is one event unto all. Yea, also the heart of the sons of men is full of evil, and madness is in their heart, while they live, and after they go, to the dead. So, again, looking at the whole situation, he says, it's madness. One, the same thing seems to happen to the man who sacrifices, who takes his lamb and cuts the throat and pours out his heart before God and realizes he's a sinner and there must be atonement. Then the same thing seems to happen to the wicked man who's just an out-and-out sinner. Same thing seems to happen to the man that swears all the time and cusses, and yet the same thing seems to happen to the man who's afraid to make a vow or an oath because he understands how solemn it is. And as he looks at this, he says, all in all, it all pans out the same. They both end up in the same place. They're both dead. And what's the sense in it all? And of course, he's missing the great facts of the resurrection. He's missing the great facts of spiritual life. Because Jesus said there are those who are alive physically who are dead spiritually. As that young man came to him and said, Lord, I'll follow you anywhere, but let me go first bury my father. It wasn't that his father was dead. The idea is, let me go first care for my father in his old age, and when I fulfill that responsibility, I'll come and follow you. Jesus said, let the dead bury their own dead. The idea is, there are many who are physically alive but spiritually dead. And spiritual death, by biblical criteria, is separation from God. Man is spiritually dead because he's separated from God. People will die having gone through this world and never accepted Jesus Christ and pass off into eternity. They're going to live eternally, but in separation from God, in outer darkness. That is spiritual death. Separation from God. And then there are those, of course, who are born of the Spirit, who come to Christ. And there's a much different destination as we look at this. It's ridiculous. Of course, he's depressed, and it's a worldly perspective. For to him that is joined to all the living, there is hope. You know, the idea is, as long as you're alive, there's at least hope. And listen to, here's the wisest man that ever lived, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. So what a perspective on life. You know, he says, look, as long as you're alive, there's at least hope that that something might happen, is the idea. And when it comes down to it, a living dog's better than a dead lion. For the living know that they shall die. Now, by and large, there are some people who expect to go out on astral planes and come back as dogs or cats or, they're out of their minds. But by and large, man accepts the fact that he's going to die, that comes to all. And the dead know not anything, which is wrong, obviously. Again, we see the rich man and Lazarus. They both knew what was going on. We see Wednesday night in our study in Revelation, we saw those under the altar crying out, how long before you avenge our blood on those that dwell on the earth? So completely wrong. The dead know not anything. I mean, that's our whole discussion tonight with Richie. I mean, as I think of him, I think, where is he standing right now? We've been in Revelation 4 and 5. Where is he standing? Are his feet upon a sea of glass? And he's looking into the presence of the Lamb. Is he singing the words that we've continually read together? Kathy told me he never really liked bright lights. I said, well, he's adjusted now. how sad Solomon saying the dead, you know, they don't know anything. Neither have they any reward. so wrong, his perspective. You know, Paul said, I'm ready now to be offered up. And henceforth there's laid up for me a crown of righteousness for all those who have served God and who love him, you know, who've done his will. We know that there are rewards. We know there's life after this. There's no doubt. And here's the wisest man that ever lived. You know, Job in his own generation was the wisest man that he ever lived, that ever lived. And he complained and he said things. And finally, when God came to him, he said, who are you, you know, that darkeneth counsel by speaking without knowledge? Job, where were you when I did this? Where were you, by the way, when I laid the foundations of the world? And by the way, Job, where were you? Have you passed yet through the gates of hell and death? I've been there, he said. You know, have you? You caused the unicorn to give birth to the young, and you know he goes on this remarkable spiel, God, about the things, of course, that he could only understand. And he says, "Your counsel, you know, you're darkening counsel by speaking without knowledge." And here Solomon's doing the same thing. Someone came up to me and asked me last week, "Now, is this, you know, this what Solomon said is true because it's the Bible?" And I said, "No, it's a true account of his mistakes. You know, it's a." I believe the Bible is inerrant. It is an anointed record of Solomon's depression. It's the honesty of an unsaved man, as it were, or a carnal perspective on life, written without error, but certainly it's not true. It's his depression. But it's recorded without error as we look at it. The complete honesty about his depression is here. He says, the dead don't know anything. They don't have any reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Now, that might be true. Also, their love and their hatred, their envy, is now perished. And how sad he is that he thinks that, because there's love that we have that's going to abide forever. Neither have they any more a portion forever in anything that is done. And here's his whole perspective, under the sun. And again, wrong. Go thy way, eat thy bread with joy, drink thy wine with a merry heart, for God now accepteth thy works. You know, what a perspective on life. The wisest man that ever lived that could have anything. He says, well, you know, here I am at the end of my life, 700 wives, 300 concubines, the richest man that ever lived. It said that he had 36, history tells he had 36 guards all over 6 foot with raven black hair, that he would grate gold dust and sprinkle it in their hair every morning and ride out on his chariot with white stallions. I mean, he got to the point where he was bored. He imported apes, it says, and monkeys, you know, I'm bored. Let's get some, how about orangutans? I've never had them. I mean, he reported these things from all over the world. He lived an opulent lifestyle. And then all in his old age, he's sitting back saying, well, eat your bread and drink your wine. That's what life's all about. How sad. Let thy garments be always white. Let thy head lack no ointment. Live joyfully with the wife whom thou lovest. If he could pick one out of 700, he was amazing. I guess he was the wisest man that ever lived. Live joyful with the wife whom thou lovest all the days of thy life, of thy vanity, of your emptiness, which he hath given thee under the sun all the days of thy vanity, for that is thy portion in this life, and in thy labor which thou takest under the sun. Again, so depressed. Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might, for there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in the grave whither thou goest. Wrong, Solomon. Whatever you do in word or deed, do it unto the Lord Jesus Christ, and do it with all of your might, because there is rewards, and there is wisdom, and there is knowledge that will endure past the grave and through the veil as we pass on into his kingdom. So, again, Solomon looking at life strictly on a carnal level. I returned, and I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, neither yet bread to the wise, nor yet riches to men of understanding, nor yet favor to men of skill, but time and chance happened to them all. So he said, as I observed life, it was all of fate. had nothing to do. You know, the battle didn't go, the race didn't go to the swift. The battle doesn't always go to the strong. Men of understanding and skill don't always get the best jobs. He said, time and circumstance happen to everybody. You know, it's all by chance, you know. You know, I heard someone, read an account where someone was questioning Charles Spurgeon about predestination, about election. And Charles Spurgeon said, you mean you were saved by fate? Not faith. You were saved by fate. It could have been the guy next to you as well as you. You know, was salvation falling out of heaven and it just happened to bounce on you instead of the guy next to you, you know. But this is what Solomon's saying. I observed all of life. And, you know, I've seen some guys wrench their heart out training. Paul loved, by the way, the games on Sunday afternoon. And he always alluded to the race and to wrestling and so forth. Probably not allowed to participate because he was a Jew and there were pagan sacrifices and so forth in Tarsus as he grew up. But he was a great fan of wrestling. He had that kind of personality. Probably wished instead of, you know, that's probably why God made Paul real small with a big nose and funny looking guy. Because if he'd made him 6'4", he'd have been in the NFL and he'd never been an apostle. So, but Paul obviously had the spirit and the heart of a man to compete and always alluded to the games. And here Solomon must have watched also and said he realized the race doesn't always go to the swift and the battle doesn't always go to the strong. And men who really strain to excel in their field, he said, yet it seems that time and chance seem to determine so many. And I don't feel that way in my life at all. I think as we look back at our lives, whether we were raised in a home with an alcoholic parent or whether we had some kind of a hardship come our way, all of those things have caused us to be we have a disposition towards certain things in our life now, and we wouldn't have been saved, many of us, if we hadn't come through that background. And to look back and continually grumble is almost to do despite to grace. And, you know, we look at where we are this evening, we look at the hope we have, we look how our lives have changed, and we think, you know, gee, if I had been in another circumstance, maybe it had happened, you know, I'd have looked a different way or something. And yet, that's what Solomon's doing. We can look back and say it was all under control. Psalm 139 says he knew us before we were born. As we were being formed in the womb, he gave us our personalities. That all our days were written out before any of them were actually a reality. That he knew our names from the foundation of the world. And somehow he sent each one of our spirits, whatever, you know, into time at his timing and his place and his knowledge, knowing that it would lead us all to personal faith in Christ and he'd be able to gather us home one day to glory, to wipe away all the tears from our eyes, to call us his sons and daughters, to embrace us and to be with us. He knew our dispositions before we lived. And he knew the race that he would have to put us through to bring our hearts to Christ. And I don't feel as I look at this at all that it's been time and chance that's determined my life, at least. And I know you don't either. And where I'm headed. For man also knoweth not his time, as the fishes that are taken in an evil net, and as the birds that are caught in the snare, so are the sons of men. Well, that's usually true, maybe. Snared at an evil time when it falls suddenly upon them. Probably, in general, most people don't know when it's going to happen. I think sometimes God is gracious to his children. I know a biblical record of Paul, of course, saying, now it's my time to be poured out. Peter, in his second epistle, says it's time for me to make my departure, my exodus. He had, God had spoken to his heart. And I have known Christians that are saying, okay, you know, it's time. They made preparations, got their house in order. But probably he's telling the truth in general. He's saying most of us don't know when it's going to come. So wisdom beckons. This wisdom have I also seen under the sun, and it seems great unto me. There was a little city, and a few men were in it. And there came a great king against it, and besieged it, and built a great bulwarks against it. Now there was found in that city a poor wise man. And he, by his wisdom, delivered the city. Yet no man remembered that same poor man. And then said I, wisdom is better than strength. Nevertheless, The poor man's wisdom is despised, and his words are not heard. How true. There's a lot of truth in this, I think. And the words of the wise man are heard in quiet more than they are the cry of him that ruleth among fools. To sit and to listen and to glean from a wise man, it's often takes the time to sit quietly and sit alone. And I think many times by observation, I know the times that I've had at least to spend with Chuck Smith and some of the men that I admire, a lot of what I've learned has been by observation, to see God's grace be a reality and at work, and has ministered to me so much. So he says, the words of wise men are heard more in quiet than the cry of him who rules among fools. Wisdom is better than weapons of war. Now he's thinking of this poor man. But yet one sinner destroys much good. Dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor. So doth a little folly him that is of reputation for wisdom and honor. Now, again, no chapter breaks. As Solomon wrote this, he's still thinking along these lines of wisdom. Again, we leave off last week at the end of chapter 8, and then we think, well, next week's a whole new chapter. Not really. You know, the chapter breaks are a blessing. I'm glad they did it. I'm not smart enough to remember the Bible without them. I can't remember the Bible with them, but at least I can help, you know. In my Bible, at least, I can find things, not by chapter and verse, but by where it is on the page and by what color the note is, and I know what corner it's in sometimes, you know. But in Solomon's mind, there was no, okay, break here, do the next chapter. He's still following on this thought of wisdom, that there's a city that's saved by a poor man who's wise when all the strength in the world wouldn't happen, and that wisdom is a good thing to have, yet one sinner destroys much good, he says, you know, brings a reproach. And it's like dead flies causing the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking odor. Now, again, we don't think much about that, but you have to realize in their day, oil was one of the main means of caring for wounds. Remember the parable of the Good Samaritan, how he fell among thieves, and the Good Samaritan came and bound this man up with oil and wine to kill some of the germs, antiseptic in the wine, and then the oil to aid with the healing. In fact, in James chapter 5, literally, where it says, any man who's sick, let him call for the elders, and they'll pray for him, anointing him with oil. It's not the word anointing for anointing. You know, we like to get anointed and prayed for. That's not the word there, really. The reality is, it says, let the elders come oiling him with oil, which is medicinal, and that the prayer of faith will save the sick. You know, the man should confess his sin. So that's all right. People ask to be anointed. We anoint them. If that helps their faith, God bless them. We'll oil them right down. There is one place where Jesus sent out his disciples and did tell them to anoint with oil. Different word. Why? Beats me. But the oil was an important part of the apothecary, the drugstore back then. And oil, you know, if you've got oil at home, Wesson oil, it keeps a pretty long time. But, of course, back in those days, if they left the lid off, you've been to the Arab market in Jerusalem, you see in what's supposedly the meat market, which is hard to believe, hot day, entrails and heads and eyeballs sitting out on the counter and flies zooming around, sitting all over this stuff. And, you know, this is for sale. Oh, sure, I'm going to buy that right away, buddy. Well, it's the same thing if the oil, the container the oil was in, was left open, though it had herbs in it or something to give it a pleasant odor. Once the flies started dive bombing in there, quickly it would become rancid and take on a smell. And he said that's just like a man of reputation for wisdom and honor. So a little folly will ruin his reputation and make him stink, you know, the idea is. A wise man's heart, wise man's heart is as his right hand, but a fool's heart is at his left. So, again, the Oriental idea that at the right hand there's honor. Jesus will come. He will come to set up his kingdom. He will separate the nations as one who separates the sheep from the goats, and he will say to his sheep, come thou sit at my right hand, and to the goats he will say, go to my left. You know, in the Oriental mind, the right hand was a place of honor. It was a place of strength. The idea is a wise man's heart is at his right hand to do good, to do what's right, to do the honorable thing. A fool's heart is at his left hand to do the wrong thing. Yea, also when he that is a fool walketh by the way, his wisdom faileth him, and he saith to everyone that he is a fool. Now, he doesn't say it with his mouth. The idea is when you get around a fool, it's not long by observation that you determine this man's a fool. His wisdom fails, and he says to everyone with his life. You know, sometimes, and you know, have to understand the Bible's description of a fool, when all this we're talking about a fool, is a little bit different than ours is today. When we talk about a fool today, we might think, man, that guy is really a fool, you know, or stupid, or the Bible says a fool is someone who says in his heart there is no God. First of all, the fool has said in his heart there is no God. The Bible says that a fool is a man who can't receive instruction. So you can have, according to biblical terms, a man who has great wisdom, who has certificates all over his walls, who doesn't believe in God, and you can't teach him or instruct him. In a by biblical definition, he's a fool. I heard A.W. Tozier. I'm listening to these tapes. What a character. I can't even tell you everything he says, but you know, this is a great 20th century divine. But he said, there's two things that make a man stupid. One's not enough education, the other's too much education. So by the biblical definition of a fool, it's not long that you're around him, and by his life he's telling you that who he is and what he's like is what it says, his actions. If the spirit of the ruler rise up against thee, leave not thy place, for yielding pacifieth great offenses. Now, you know, there's some proverbs mixed in here. This is a good one. If your boss, the ruler, maybe the person you're accountable to, if he rises up against you, he's having a bad day, maybe he argued with his wife before he left the house, maybe his dog chewed up the sofa, you know what I mean? I mean, these are the kind of things in life that set us off. We're tuned pretty fine, you know, even us spiritual giants. And it's funny how we can, you know, decline so quickly by so little pressure. And if your boss comes in and it says, and he's giving you a hard time, he rises up against you, leave not thy place. Don't quit right away. Don't be a sorehead and get offended and quit right away is what it's saying. Because yielding pacifies great offenses. You know, Solomon also wrote in Proverbs that a soft answer turns away wrath. We all know that verse and none of us practice it. Be honest. That's a tough one, man, because you get somebody who's ragging on you and right in your face. I'm not thinking, gee, a soft answer turns away wrath. You know, I'm thinking, what? You know? There's wisdom here. Don't quit right away. Stick it out. The guy's human. Hopefully he'll calm down. Be pacified. There is an evil which I have seen under the sun. He's seen a lot of them, as he's been saying this all the way through the book. As an error which proceedeth from the ruler. Now, this is one of the evils he's seen under the sun is on the part of men that are in governing positions, that are ruling. He says, folly is set in great dignity, and the rich or the wise sit in a low place. He says, I've seen fools exalted and wise men humbled, is the idea. I have seen servants upon horses and princes walking as servants upon the earth. He that diggeth a pit shall fall into it. So be careful how you set traps for other people. I have an uncle, and if you ever listen to this tape, I hope this is, it's not a complete application, but it's kind of likens itself to this. He was working at Bud's and down on Hunting Park Avenue, and if you ever seen it there, you park sometimes at the parking lot's full. You're parking all over the world to get a parking spot there. Well, he forgot where he parked, and he came out at the end of the day and was convinced his car was stolen because it wasn't where he thought he had left it. So he went back in, called the police. Look, my car is stolen. The guy said, okay, and we'll look for it. And he said, yeah, but the problem is I left my wallet in there. You know, this is before the days when your picture was on your driver's license. My driver's license, my owner car, everything's in there. So if you find this guy, you know, you can't believe him because he's going to give, he's got all the credentials and all this. And they said, all right, and you know the story already by where I'm going. It wasn't long before he remembered where he parked his car and was on the way home and pull him over, you know, and he gets out and the guy's, he says, hey, I know, I found my car. And then the cop said, sure, buddy, sure, get in. And my aunt had to go down and prove who he was so he could get his car back. So, he that diggeth a pit shall fall into it. And you can make application. That's not a strict application. It's rather warning us not to, to try to ensnare and to entrap other people. And sometimes that can be fun, you know that. Whoso breaketh a hedge, a serpent shall bite him. The idea is breaking down a stone wall. You've seen them in Israel. Often they pile up the stones, take them out of the field. It serves two purposes. It gets the rocks out of the field, and it provides a wall that's a boundary between properties. It says somebody goes out and tries to break down the wall. Lots of times that's where the viper makes his nest, in the stone wall, gets bit by a serpent. The idea here is not being dishonest, not breaking down walls, not setting traps for other people. Whoso removeth stones shall be hurt therewith. The landmarks, they would set up a pillar of stones, and that pillar of stones would be the border of your property. So what you would do sometimes at night, if you were a sneak, you'd go out and move the pillar of stones about 10 foot in the other direction, give yourself a little more room to plant next spring. And that was a sin in Israel, removing the landmarks. You hear about that as you read through and the boundaries. Whoso removeth stone shall be hurt therewith, and he that cleaveth wood shall be endangered thereby. Now, I don't understand that much about the second half of it, cutting wood. Except that, again, there was no verses, so we'll look on here. If the iron, the axe head, be blunt, and he do not whet the edge, the person who's cutting with the axe, now this all applies to the wood being dangerously cut, and the person who's cutting doesn't sharpen the axe, then must he put more strength to it. But wisdom is profitable to direct. If the guy's got a brain in his head, he's going to get out a file or something and sharpen his axe, and you don't have to exert yourself as much to cut the wood, and there's less chance of the axe head flying off the handle and of you dropping dead of a heart attack trying to cut wood with a dull axe. The idea is sharpen up, buddy, will you? That's the idea. Surely the serpent will bite without enchantment, and a babbler is no better. So you've seen these guys, and the cobra comes up, you know. He says a serpent will bite without enchantment, without the guy sitting there with a flute, and then, you know, the serpent comes up kind of in a daze. Well, a serpent will bite without enchantment, and a fool's no better. You know, the backbiter is the same way. A babbler will do the same thing, bite without enchantment. So I guess if you have a friend who's a babbler, enchant them, I don't know. The words of a wise man's mouth are gracious, but the lips of a fool will swallow up himself. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is mischievous madness. Boy, I've known some like that. A fool also is full of words. A man cannot tell what shall be, and what shall be after him, who can tell? So a fool, he knows about it. You know people like this. You can't tell them anything because they know about everything in life. You think, why aren't you in the space program? You're the smartest human being I ever met. You know, you can't tell them anything is what it says here. A fool knows everything, and yet who can tell what's going to come afterwards and what's going to be? And you know those people that, at this, in light of all the mysteries of the world, they seem to know everything. The labor of the foolish wearieth every one of them, because he knoweth not how to go to the city. Always lost. Woe to thee, O land, when thy king is a child, and thy princes eat in the morning. The idea is feast in the morning. You know, it's not a sin, and it's not a problem, ladies, if your husband eats in the morning. That's not what it's saying. You're prince. It's eating and drinking in the morning is the idea. The normal thing was to drink wine with the evening meal. That's why on the day of Pentecost, they said, how can these men be drunk? It's only 9 o'clock in the morning. The idea was you didn't drink wine with the morning meal. Some people in our society do. You don't drink wine with the morning meal, and you don't eat meat with the morning meal. You know, the morning meal was usually bread and fruit and so forth. It was at evening when they partook of meat and drank wine. And it says, woe to the land when the princes get up and they feast in the morning. They start their day with a big glass of wine and a T-bone. Feasting in the morning. Blessed art thou, O land, when thy king is the son of a noble, and thy princes eat in due season at the proper time. And the reason they eat is for strength, not for gluttony or to party, and not for drunkenness. So it goes without saying, blessed is the land who has wise men running things. I think Senate ethics has become an oxymoron in our own land. One of the greatest tragedies to me, and I'm not expressing an opinion either way, was to see Kennedy and Biden, who we know are guilty of certain things, picking on Thomas, and who we weren't sure was guilty, and then to drag that on in insanity for a week and a half and then drop the whole thing without ever finding out who was telling the truth. That was perjury. I mean, either one was lying or the other was lying. Somebody, I sat around and thought, I watched this stupid thing for a week and a half and they're not going to tell me who won, you know? I mean, how'd this really come out? You know, there was a time in our land when the men met every day for prayer before they started, when they were serious about God, and they didn't have to sit back and look at pornography and say, gee, we can't tell what's filthy and what's art, because they knew a 10-year-old could make that decision. They weren't afraid of special interest groups in that day. You had the right to live and to worship and to farm your land. You didn't have the right to pervert somebody else's children. That's not a right that should be given to anybody. But the land is blessed when there are righteous and wise men ruling. That goes without saying. When they're drunk in the morning, I could tell you some stories too. I won't. By much slothfulness, a building is decayed. I like to say too that the car is decayed the same way. And the lawn. You know, four kids in the church. One of the frustrating things is life is to come home and be so tired you feel like dropping dead of a heart attack and thinking, you know, when am I ever going to paint the fence or get the lawn cut or, you know, when's this ever going to happen? When the kids are breaking things faster than you're fixing them, you know. And then on top of that, if you're a sluggard, you just sit around and watch your life fall apart around you. Here it says, to the slothful, the building decays. The car falls apart, the lawn doesn't get cut, everything falls apart. You can make your own application. And through idleness of the hands, the house droppeth through. A feast is made for laughter. And I don't have a problem with that. One of the enjoyable things about eating with Christians is laughing your head off. I don't think the Lord minds. And wine to make merry. And I didn't put my seal of approval on that, thank you. I'm plenty merry without it. But money answereth all things. feast is for laughter and wine is to make the heart merry, but money's the answer to every problem. Can't believe after he was doing good for so long here and then he has to throw this one in. Curse not the king, no, not in thy thought. Curse not the rich in your bedchamber, for a little bird of the air shall carry the voice. You hear that saying? A little bird told me, this is where it came from, this verse right here in Ecclesiastes. Came from Solomon, came from right here, I'm not kidding. You know, what he's saying is, you know, one of the worst things about knowing a secret is you can't tell anybody. A secret is something that you promise not to tell and make the next guy swear to do what you promised. You know, he says, you know how it is. You whisper in your bedchamber, you tell one person, and somehow a little bird gets it to the next guy, and you're in trouble. You know, I heard that you said, that I said, that your aunt said, that we said when we were with her, that you said, that you know how it gets. It's easier just to put your... keep your mouth shut. because a little bird of the air shall carry the voice, and that which hath wings shall tell the matter. Seems that way, doesn't it, sometimes? Now, cast thy bread upon the waters, for thou shalt find it after many days. Give a portion to seven, and also to eight, for thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. So, making an allusion to a practice, at least when the Nile would overflow its banks, and I'm not sure. They say that when the Jordan in this day would overflow its banks, sometime the Jordan would be over a half mile wide. Those of you who've been to Israel, and you see how the Jordan winds down the Jordan Valley like a snake, continual like this. Well, what would happen before there was a dam at the southern end of the Sea of Galilee and so forth during the rainy season? What would happen is the Jordan would overflow its banks, and it would just start to overflow all those S's. There would be so much water coming down, and there's a time of the season when it would overflow its banks. But in the Nile, when the Nile overflowed its banks, it would run into all these fields that were irrigated, almost form a situation like rice paddies. And what they would do sometimes is they would throw their seed, their wheat, and what they were planting, they would just throw it on the water as the water was running in the fields, and they would let it carry the seed right out all the way into their fields in these big, you know, bays of mud. And then as it dried, they'd have a rich harvest. The seed would be carried out and take root and grow. And he's making an allusion to that in the area of giving. To sow your bread upon the waters, to be generous is the idea. Because there's a rich harvest that will come back. Thou shalt find it after many days. It was an allusion to something they understood. Charity. Giving. Of whatever means you're able. Give a portion to seven, also to eight. For thou knowest not what evil shall be upon the earth. You don't know when it's going to be your turn to need. So be an example in giving. We've got some great guys around here. Frank Gianni and Bill Eske. We've got some guys that are... Frank's a great example in giving, but won't spend a dime on himself. I mean, he can squeeze Abraham Lincoln to the other side of the penny. But he'll give it away to anybody with a tear in their eye and get anything from him. A great example, says Bill Eske. And some guys, you watch them, never ask for a pat on the back, never ask for any thanks, and continually... giving. And he's making an allusion to that, to cast your bread. Now, Paul tells us that, and in the very much the same way, he who sows sparingly shall reap sparingly. If you sow generously, that's the way you're going to reap. And making an allusion to the same thing. The problem is the logical mind tells us, hoard, and you'll have more. I mean, that seems the most logical to me, and yet God has his way of, as we, you know, Jesus says, as you give, that's the way it's going to be given to you, pressed down, shaken together, beyond measure, the idea is, because God has a different way of keeping books, in this life and in the world to come. So, understand this, that there is the teaching in the church that you give to get, and what they do is they take covetousness and they play on your motives, which is only sin, and God will never bless that motive. You know, it's interesting, in the book of Malachi, it says, bring in the whole tithe, or the complete tithe. That means a tenth of your cucumbers, a tenth of your lambs, a tenth of your puppies, a tenth of your tomatoes, a tenth of your money. Bring in the whole tithe, God was saying to Israel. In the New Testament, the only time it mentions the word tithe in the entire New Testament is when Jesus is upbraiding the Pharisees, and he says, you hypocrites, you tithe of your mint and your cumin and your little seeds, you know, nine for me, one for God, nine for you, with mustard seeds and cumin and dill, and yet you neglect mercy and judgment and so forth, these kind of things. You strain at a gnat and you swallow a camel. The Pharisees sometimes have a gnat flu in their throat. They didn't know if that gnat had been, it sucked blood on a Gentile. So, you know, they got this unclean gnat. You see them, you know, trying to get, you ever done that with it? Maybe a glass of lemonade and you think you got a piece of citrus and it's really a fly or something, you know. Spit it out and a wing comes out. You know. They strain in a gnat and swallow a camel. You know, complete hypocrisy is the idea. And the New Testament, as far as I can see, does not enforce tithing. Now, I have had ministers call me because they hear me say that on a radio and write me 10-page letters and rake me over the coals. And I look back in my Bible again, and to me, tithing is an ordinance. It's called a commandment. It's called a law. And Colossians says that the blood of Christ has cleansed us, washed us, and that we're no longer under the ordinance, commandments, and the laws. And I believe that Jesus wants all that we have. Not don't get me wrong. You're not going to see me on Prime Time. The idea is... The idea is our lives are His. Even in the Old Testament, He wanted one day out of seven. He only wanted a tenth of the increase. And if you understand that properly, it was only a lease for the land. He said, you'll never sell the land from generation to generation. The land is mine. You give me a tenth of your increase, that's your payment. It was really rent for the land, is what it actually was. And He said, if a tenth comes in straight across the board, you won't have any problems in the nation. There'll be stores, the poor will be taken care of. It was true. But in the New Testament... I believe the concept is giving. And if we don't, you know, again, if you're not making your budget and you can't even buy Huggies for your kids, there's no sense you taking a tenth and sticking the offering and going, here, you know, I'm there, you know, because you ain't going to get nothing for that when you come into the kingdom. You put $5 in because you love Jesus with all your heart, you're going to reap eternal rewards for that. I would be wrong if I enforced tithing on you because I got to look out for you guys eternally too. You know, there's certain things you do now where you're laying up. And you have to understand that. If you do it for the right motive, if you don't have any money, you can cut somebody's lawn. You know, I'll tell you the truth, it's easier for me to put money in the offering than it is to give sometimes. Because sometimes somebody wants to bend my ear and I know they're going to do it till my ear bleeds and I don't want to give. Sometimes, you know, sometimes it's a matter of cutting somebody's lawn or doing something for somebody, or you see somebody from church that really irks you and their tire slapped by the side of the road and you go, you know, you know, giving, you know, Jesus wants our lives. He wants to press us into those circumstances, you know, where we're not just love, joy, and peace, but long suffering, temperance, meekness, that kind of fruit can be used also in our lives, you know. So Solomon, understanding that, says to cast your bread upon the waters, that we should give liberally. Paul says if you give liberally, that's the way you're going to reap in life, in this world, and in the world to come. There's no guarantees that the payment will come now, but I guarantee it'll come. It's sowing and reaping. There's a law in the scripture about it. If you sow to the wind, you'll reap the whirlwind. You sow to the Spirit, you'll reap of the Spirit eternal life. So with whatever means God has given you, your finances, your life, your strength, your talents, your ministry, whatever it is, your heart, spend yourself. The idea is for the eternal things, because what a sad thing it is to show up in glory and not have stored up those eternal riches that will abide the fire and be with us forever. What a shame it will be to stand in glory and not have at least one crown that we can throw at the Master's feet. So Solomon says here, cast your bread upon the waters, it will return. It's an investment program, he understood. Now, if the clouds be full of rain, they empty themselves upon the earth. And if the tree fall towards the south or towards the north, in the place where the tree falleth, that's where it's going to be. And he that observeth the wind shall not sow. And he that regardeth the clouds shall not reap. So, you know, the encouragement here is first in giving, the way we should spend our lives. And then he says, look, if the clouds come and the rain falls, it comes down and it's on the ground. If a tree falls over north, it lays north. If a tree falls over south, it lays south. And if somebody stands around in the field observing the wind, they're not going to sow. They're going to say, and you know people like this. You know, they seem like in any given circumstance, they can see the danger. You know, and that's what he's alluding to here. He that observes the wind shall not sow, and he that regardeth the clouds is not going to reap. The idea is, when it comes time to sow, you know, some people look around and say, oh, it's too windy to sow today. We better stay inside, you know. What happens if a tornado comes, you know? You know these people, you know. They say there's going to be high winds, but there might be a tornado if we go out. We might get sucked up, you know what I mean? And it's time to, you know, when it's time to sow, to go out and reap. He says, is there work? Worried about the clouds. Gee, what happens if we get out and we get hit by lightning? You know, there's just, you know, so he says, look, when it comes to sowing and reaping, if it's cloudy, if it's windy, life is full of problems. Don't let the winds and the clouds and the problems of life keep you from investing in eternal things. Don't let them keep you from sowing and from reaping in regards to the kingdom of God. Because if you want, you'll always find a reason to not trust God and to worry. And you know, maybe God is speaking to someone here tonight. I was thinking about this before I came up. Maybe there's someone here really, maybe you're on the edge of making some decision, or you think, gee, I want to just, but oh no, this is how you, look, wisdom from above is first pure and is peaceable and is easily entreated. And people sometimes will ask me, gee, do you think the Lord's telling me to do this or the Lord's telling me to do that? And I have to say, I'm trying to figure out what the Lord's telling me to do. I've been trying to figure out for years. I'm not real good at it yet. So I could never tell you what he's telling you to do. He's got your phone number. He knows your address. He'll call you. He can afford it. He'll reverse the charges if he can't, you know. Cut me a break. But I do know that one of the things I've learned as a barometer in making those decisions is wisdom from above is pure and is peaceable. It's just wholesome and it's good. And I usually go with what I have a peace about in my heart. And I find as I look at life that life basically stinks in a lot of ways. A lot of great things about life. I love life. I love to get up every day and be alive. But there are just a lot of broken hearts and broken lives and pain and suffering in the world that we live in. And there's always danger. It's dangerous to be alive these days. It's dangerous to breathe the air. It's dangerous to drink the water. You know, first they were saying, don't drink the milk. You'll get strontium 90. And you'll get. Then they were saying, well, milk may prevent cancer. Then they were saying, don't eat red meat. And then they were saying, well, all the chicken and veal's got antibiotics. Everybody's back to red meat again. I mean, you know, trust God. Live your life. Move on. If you're here tonight and you've been holding up, move on what the Spirit is pressing you to do. And don't stand around worried about the clouds and the rain all day, or you'll never be out in the field sowing and reaping. Because there is a harvest field out there. And the harvest is white unto harvest, and the laborers are few. And some people just worry their whole life and never do anything. He says, he that observes the wind is never going to sow. And he that worries about clouds, he's never going to be out there reaping. Don't allow inactivity in your life through fear. As thou knowest not what is the way of the Spirit, nor how the bones do grow in the womb of her that is with child, even so thou knowest not the works of God, who maketh them all. You know, the idea is yet we prepare for childbirth. You know, we don't know whether it's going to rain today. We don't know whether the wind's going to blow, but we can stand around and be afraid. And then he says, it's like, you know, you don't know what is the way of the Spirit. You don't know how bones are formed in the womb when a baby's growing, and yet you go and you prepare the nursery, you buy the crib, you prepare for the birth. So the idea is we don't understand, you know, how the ways of God and all of life circumstances either, but we've got to move. We've got to sow and to reap. You know, and scientists will tell us today, well, we understand how the bones are formed, and we just, you know, they can sit around and tell us, well, we understand that there's genes and there's chromosomes, and that those genes and chromosomes carry the code to form certain cells, and those cells know that they're supposed to be bone cells. They get all the information all the other cells have. I don't know how they know which cells are supposed to be when they're forming. And we don't know who programmed the whole thing in the first place. See, that's the first part of it. He says, we don't know the way of the Spirit, because there's a life force beyond consciousness and sight. There's something beyond it all that's programmed. Life itself. Scientists still haven't figured out what that is. And even as the baby forms in the womb, I mean, right before the liver is formed, vessels go to the area where the liver is going to be, nerve endings go to the area where the liver is going to be, then the liver forms into the vessels and nerve endings so that it has what it needs as once it's formed. I mean, it's a remarkable, miraculous process in every single way, and that is beyond finding out. How can it happen? You know, how can we understand? When Kathy was down the hospital, the last two, Josh and Hannah, she kept going into premature labor. She starts around 7 months, and then tributyline and all the insanity. And I'm asking these guys, well, now why does this happen? And why does, you know? And I think they get tired of us. We drive them crazy. And then, well, what actually makes the labor start? And the guy said, that is the $64 million question. If we could figure that out, then we could stop this whole process. We make some money. We could help a lot of people. And he said, the theory that they have is what starts labor is the baby decides when he wants to come, secretes, and as he or she urinates in the sac, in the amniotic fluid, that they emit a certain enzyme that hadn't been there before. That enzyme is absorbed through the walls of the placenta and sends a signal to the existing nerves in the abdominal area, and within 24 to 48 hours they build nerve bridges that were non-existent before to coordinate all the muscles that are going to be needed to push for the delivery, and the whole thing clicks on. And then when it's done, all those nerve endings, those little bridges, dissolve and go away again, so all those muscles, you know, so your wife's not walking around going the rest of her life, you know. You know, the more they find out about it, the more it only proves to me there's a pretty incredible designer behind the whole system, man. It's just awesome. And that's good, isn't it? That they go away, those little nerve endings. As thou knowest not what is the way of the Spirit, nor how the bones do grow in the womb of her that is with child, even so you don't know all the works of God and what God's going to do in regard to sowing and reaping, yet we prepare for the child. In the morning sow thy seed, and in the evening withhold not thine hand, for thou knowest not whether what shall prosper, either this or that, or whether they both alike shall be good. So don't withhold your hand. The idea is in all of our lives that the sowing, I believe, is enjoined upon us. The production has nothing to do with us. Paul says one man sows, another man waters, but only God brings the increase. That, you know, when he's talking about him and Apollos, some say I'm of Apollos, some say I'm of Paul. He said, we're nothing. We're just human beings. We're just dust. One man sows, another man waters, but it's only God that brings the increase. So our rewards, our sowing that will be rewarded is only in regards to our faithfulness to whatever it is that God has asked us to do. It will be rewarded in regards to faithfulness, not in regards to production. Only God brings the fruit. God brings it. You know, some people work in the mission field for years, and all they'll do in the mission field is sow and sow and sow, and never ever see in their whole life a soul saved. And then a man or a team will come in behind them, and they'll see one of the greatest revivals ever taken place. And when they stand before the Lord, they're going to be rewarded according to their faithfulness, not according to the production. Or, you know, you're going to see grandmothers standing around the throne of God who were more faithful in praying for their grandchildren and instructing them than Billy Graham and many men of God probably were in their ministries. And when we come there into glory, the rewards are going to be according to faithfulness. And I think many times we look around and say, well, maybe Pastor Joe, you know, he does this, and, you know, he's got a big responsibility, or, you know, or this person, or Billy Graham, or this person's got a great field in the missions, or a great hospital ministry, or here's a great writer that's written books, and I'm only this. Look, right in front of you, where your eyeballs can see, you know, is a ministry God's given you today. However big or small it grows, and however many lives it touches, that's His. What He's asked you to do is to sow within the parameters of the field He's set in front of you, and to be faithful at that. And according to your faithfulness, you will be rewarded as you step into the kingdom. So the problem is our hesitancy. It's not the scope of our ministry. It's that we don't enter into it at all, however big or small it is. That we say, gee, it's going to rain, or it's cloudy. You know what I mean? It's not a good day. You know, he's likening it to those who worry as it comes to sowing and reaping in the field. And he says it won't be any production. You don't know the way the bones are formed in the womb, and yet you prepare for your baby to come. So he says, so it is. We don't know the workings of God. So he says, in the morning, sow. He says, go out and work, and in the evening withhold not thy hand. We can't tell how it's all going to work out, is what he's saying here, and whether both alike may turn out wonderful. It might just be great, is what he's saying. Truly, the light is sweet, and a pleasant thing it is for the eyes to behold the sun. I agree. But if a man live many years and rejoice in them all, yet let him remember the days of darkness, for they shall be many, and all that comes is vanity. What a depressing soul. I would much rather have hung around with David, chasing giants, running through the hills like a partridge on the mountain, and because wherever he was, at least he was writing songs or talking about one thing have I desired of the Lord, that will I seek after, that might, you know, see, behold your beauty all the days of my life. I might inquire in your temple. I mean, Solomon seems to have these highs and lows and then bottom out again. You know, after this great discussion about sowing and reaping, then he says, well, if you like light, enjoy it, because the days of darkness are coming. They're going to be many. You know, after this great discourse on being faithful and sowing. So that's not true. There's days of tremendous light ahead of us, not days of darkness. There's days of light that we haven't even been able to conceive of or dream of. In fact, the light is so brilliant, it says that when Jesus Christ comes, that the brilliance of his presence will destroy the Antichrist, incinerate him. The brightness of his coming will destroy the beast and the false prophet. I mean, we can't even imagine the brilliance of our inheritance and what it is. It says that all the saints will shine like the stars of heaven when we enter into the kingdom prepared by our Father. Remarkable things are ahead of us. So, again, yes, I believe the Bible's inerrant. Yes, as we read through the book of Ecclesiastes, we have an accurate record, but it doesn't mean it's right. We have the accurate record of a depressed man. It's the same thing as you read through the book of Job. Job's counselors are given bad advice, but we have the inerrant record of their bad advice there. You know, that's the idea. So, you know, it might sound confusing. It's all right. Just read John. It'll all come. It comes line upon line, precept upon precept, here a little, there a little. Be faithful. And you know, Chuck Smith told me that he studied through the Bible over 50 times, and every time he sees something he's never seen before, you know. So there's no end to that. It isn't like we're ever lagging behind anyone else. We're all in the present light where God has us. So let's stand, pray, read ahead.